Now, as I start talking, if you think I talk funny, that is because I do. Because I'm a born and bred Texan with a true Texas twang. Before I begin my talk, I want to tell you about my medallions that I'm wearing. You know, I was going to stand up on a stool so everybody could see them, but y'all can see them after the meeting. This first medallion is my silver medallion, 25 years, that Willie B., my sponsor, gave me last year for my 25th AA birthday. Now, that's Willie B. of Spring, Texas. Thank you. Now, Willie has been my sponsor the last 8 years because one of my sponsors died and one of my sponsors moved out of the state. And even though I have been sober 18 years, I still felt that I needed a backup sponsor. So I asked Willie B. of Spring, Texas, and it was a real smart move on my part because she's responsible for me being here tonight. Now, this other medallion, it's a bronze medallion. There's a little story attached to this. Have any of you ever seen the musical or the movie, The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas? Well, there was a famous whorehouse in Texas called the Chicken Ranch at LaGrange, Texas. And it's located between the University of Texas and Texas A&M. And it did a thriving business. But a TV personality in Houston got crosswise with the sheriff down there. He accused him of taking bribes, and all this adverse publicity closed it down. So there was a lot of moaning and groaning when the Chicken Ranch closed down, I've heard. I don't know. But I'd had my beads several months and worn them and didn't pay any attention to this medallion, and I looked down there one day and I saw a chicken and a rooster engraved on it. And it said, The Chicken Ranch, LaGrange, Texas. And I looked on the other side and it says, Good for All Night. This little gray-haired woman nearly fainted when I read that. My name is Mary and I am an alcoholic. And I have been sober since April the 21st of 1964. And this miracle of sobriety, this amazing grace, is because of a divine and loving providence. My two beloved sponsors, Gloria P. and Lee H., because of the action involved in taking the 12 steps and because of people exactly like you. I grew up in the small, in the West Texas town of Breckenridge, and it's deep in the heart of Texas. And my mother and father were the social leaders of the church group in this town, and they entertained a lot. But being good Baptists, they didn't drink alcohol, and they didn't serve alcohol. But they weren't for it, and they weren't against it. And my little friend's parents at the country club set drank alcohol and served alcohol, and it was just all right. And I grew up in my formative years thinking alcohol was a beverage. And the good Lord knows it ain't no soda pop. It's a mood altering chemical formula, and it was so toxic to me it almost cost me my life. Now, I am married, and lately I have been thinking about alcoholics in marriage for some reason. I know there's a man in Houston in AA that's already been married 11 times. And I sponsor a woman in AA that has been married 8 times. And my friend Jack S. of Louisville, Kentucky, tells about his friend that said he had jars of peanut butter that lasted longer than some of his marriage. I just want to tell y'all, I didn't get to change all those partners and have all that fun. Because all of my life, I have been married to the same husband one day at a time. I am the mother of two grown sons, and I thank God every day they're grown and raised. You taught me in AA that I could live no other life but my own. I could not live my son's life, and as a result of this, I let go of these sons, and they live their lives and tend to their business. I live my life and tend to my business, and we have a pretty good relationship. Now, I am a grandmother, but I ain't the babysitting kind of grandmother. The idea of baking cookies and entertaining grandchildren is just not the way I want to spend my day. And I belong to an old and honorable profession. I am a housewife. Now, I am not a member of the oldest profession. And it's a damn good thing. Considering my mean personality and how ugly I look, I would have starved to death. I was a senior in high school when I took my first drink, and it ended in complete disaster. I got drunk, I got sick, I threw up on everybody just like a flamethrower. Everybody was dodging me. And the next morning when I woke up with my first hangover, I want you to know that I suffered a lingering death for 2 whole days. I didn't think I was ever going to get over that hangover. But this was such a bad trip to me, and it was so humiliating that I didn't drink anything for the next 8 or 10 years. And in that length of time, I had married, and I was the mother of these 2 small sons. And we were buying a new used home and a new used car, all on 1 salary. And there wasn't enough money left over for me to have help with my housework. And I had an awful lot of housework to do, and I hated housework. And you know, Irma Bombeck says, housework, if it's done right, can kill you. But I felt about housework like this little hippie bride. She told her best friend, she said, oh, housework is such a drag. She said, you wash the dishes and make up the beds, and 3 weeks later you have to do it all over. That's true, too, incidentally. Every housewife in here knows that. And one afternoon I was trying to wade through a big ironing, and oh, back in those days you had to iron everything but the socks and the underwear. And a friend came by and suggested a cold beer. And I remember thinking, well, oh, it's just a beverage. And when I drank that beer that afternoon, alcohol did something for me. First, it made me feel lighthearted and gay. I just felt wonderful. And it gave me energy. And on 2 beers, I got through that ironing. I had dinner on the table when my husband came home. And I felt so good, I thought I had found the answer. And oh boy. And you know what happened then. I started drinking 2 to 4 beers a day to get my house clean. 4 to 6 beers a day to get the house clean. 6 to 8 beers a day. I had the cleanest house in Houston. I was such a good housekeeper, I even put newspapers under the cuckoo clock. When I got up to 8 to 10 beers, that's when I decided I would switch to bourbon. And within 2 years after drinking that beer that afternoon, I was in serious trouble with my alcoholism, only I didn't know that was what was the matter with me. And this is when I started experiencing a personality change. And I always stop and ask if anyone, did any of you ever have a personality change when you drank? Oh, well, I want you to know that mine was so dangerous and so bizarre that my family had to take the firing pins out of all the guns in the house. Because when they would argue with me, or they would accuse me, or they would criticize me, in my rage, I would grab the guns and I would try to shoot them. Now, I ain't called shotgun for nothing. And I am described perfectly in the big book on page 21 in 3 sentences where it says the alcoholic does absurd, incredible, and tragic things while drinking. He is a regular Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. And that describes me to a T. And my family got to where they could anticipate my, they called them spells, but it was just really insanity is what it was. And they would hide the guns from me, but I could find it. Incidentally, we did have a revolver, and that gun just flew out the door after I started shooting at people. I couldn't find it anywhere. No wonder, you know. But I could find the guns, and then they got to where they locked up all the ammunition from me out in the pump house with a great big key. And they had me foiled for a while. But one morning, I got up to get my husband and these two children off to school. I think the youngest one was in kindergarten. And I was remembering how mean they had been to me the night before. They had jumped all over me. They had criticized me. And they all had tongues of vipers. And then they had locked up all the shells from me, and I couldn't shoot them. And I was in my living room watching the clock get up to 9 o'clock because it took me 15 minutes to get to the liquor store. And many a morning I had gotten to the liquor store before it opened, and I would be standing out there with those winos and those weirdos, and this was humiliating. And I was exactly like those winos. There was just a thin thread between me and those winos. And I was behaving pretty weird, so I really had no business to look down on those weirdos, but I did. But anyway, I was going to wait till straight up 9 o'clock and go to the liquor store so I could press in there like a lady and buy my 3 half pints of Old Crow. And while I was watching the clock, tick-tock slowly up to 9 o'clock, I was remembering how mean they had been to me the night before, and a very sick, diabolical thought came to my mind. I thought, well, I know just what I'll do. I'll stop back by the hardware store, and I'll buy my own ammunition. And I did, and I didn't buy ordinary shells. I bought hollow points. Now, these shells are not designed to wound or to wound. They are designed to devastate. So this lovely little wife and mother came home from the liquor store and the hardware store with several boxes of devastating ammunition. But I knew what they would do to me when they found I had this, so I started hiding these shells all over the house, upstairs and downstairs and under the carpet and in the drapes, and every place I could think to hide some shells, 10 or 12 at a time. You know, I've often wondered what those people thought that bought that house from us. Now, after I had outsmarted an alcoholic husband and two small sons, I felt real smug. And nothing uneventful happened for several months. I didn't always get mean when I drank. Sometimes I drank and loved everybody, and sometimes I drank and just peacefully passed out. Sometimes I drank and was industrious and worked all day. But I never knew what was going to happen to me when I drank. But one Saturday afternoon, my husband and these two boys were out in the backyard, and they were pitching horseshoes. And they were having such a good time. And I was in the house drinking. My husband is a beer alcoholic, and the icebox is full of beer. And what I was doing, I was sipping on his beer. Then I'd go in my dresser drawer and take two or three slugs of Old Crow and come back and chase it with his beer. And I want you to know that I drank so much Old Crow before I got to this program that that's exactly what I looked like 26 and a half years ago. I'm just glad I didn't drink Old Granddad. Or Wild Turkey. My husband came in to get a beer, and he says, looked at me, and he says, Mary, how in the hell can you be so drunk on two beers? I looked up at him so innocent-like, and I said, I don't know. It must be my metabolism. I didn't even know what that meant, but it satisfied him. And he got a beer and went outside, and that old mean spell had been coming over me, and I didn't want anybody to have a good time. If I was miserable, I wanted everybody else miserable. So I thought, they're having such a good time out there, I'm going to shake them up a little bit. So I got my .22 automatic rifle. Now, I had won this in a poker game one night when I was drunk. And I know after the poker game, I woke up that morning, this .22 automatic rifle was on the dining room table, and I asked my husband, I said, where'd that gun come from? He said, you won it last night in the poker game. I remember saying, the hell you say? I must have been a pretty good poker player when I was drunk. But anyway, I loaded my .22 automatic rifle, and I went out on the back porch, and all I did was fire into the ground two or three times, and I shook them up again. Oh, you never saw a covey of quail scatter. They just went, whoop, you know. And then one went east, and one went west, and one went over the cuckoo's nest. But one went behind the boat shed, and one went behind a great big oak tree, and one went behind the side of the house, and they were catcalling back and forth. What in the world had happened? I had double-crossed them again, and they came to two conclusions. The first conclusion was that gun was loaded. And the second conclusion was, so was I. So it was after this that they started taking the firing pins out of all the guns in the house. You know, one of the most insidious phases of this disease of alcoholism is some of us turn against those that we love and need the most. And I can well identify with any man in this room that got drunk and abused his wife and children. But after they had taken the firing pins out of the guns, my husband just knew he had pulled my fangs, so to speak. But it was after this, when I felt threatened and insane, I would revert to the butcher knives and the meat cleavers and the ice picks. And many a morning I have gotten up to fix breakfast for my family, and I would open the knife drawer, and there wouldn't be a knife or a beer opener or anything in that drawer with a point or an edge on it. And my heart would just sink. And I would make that long, slow walk down to my son's bedroom, never knowing what I was going to find. But when I checked them out and they had all their ears and they were breathing and they had all their noses and everything, oh, I was so relieved and grateful. But when I had found these butcher knives up under their little pillows, I would know I had just been dreadful the night before. And I'd reach ahead of them and take a butcher knife so I could go back and finish breakfast. I'd put the knives in the sink. And I had the window over my kitchen sink, and it faced out toward the east. And always about this time, the sun was rising. And I know I would look out through the trees to the sunrise, and I'd think, if there is a God, he is in the sunrise. And I would say, my God, I have done it again. What is the matter with me? Because I didn't know I had a disease called alcoholism that was causing this insane behavior. And it was long about this time that the suicide attempts came into play. I tried to commit suicide so many times it just got to be old hat around our house. One evening my husband came in from work. He looked at the gun rack and he said, Mary, where is my shotgun? And I said, it's upstairs. And he said, well, what is it doing upstairs? And I said, well, I was planning to shoot myself. And he undid his tie and walked past me and he said, what, again? And once I jumped out of a car going about 80 miles an hour. And I spent 8 days in the hospital after this little stunt. And where I jumped out, I jumped out and there were great big pieces of concrete, old broken railroad ties, all kind of peril in that ditch that I jumped in. And I just rolled end over end. And I didn't break a bone, but I skinned myself alive. I just had abrasions all over me. And every morning, that old mean doctor would come in there with a big old pair of tweezers. I think I started his morning off when he could come in there and pull the dead skin off that had formed in the night so new skin could form. And every day for 8 days, I would scream in pain, and he would say, well, you shouldn't have jumped. And for 8 days, I would say, well, hell, I know that now. But, you know, I knew the law of averages was going to catch up with me, and I was going to succeed in killing myself. And I really didn't want to die. I just didn't want to live this sick way I was living. And this is when I decided I would go to a specialist, an internist, and find out if there was something wrong with me organically, physically. And this was the beginning of my prescription phase of my alcoholism. And before it was over, I took energizers, stabilizers, tranquilizers, barbiturates, and narcotics, and I drank a lot of Paragard. Matter of fact, I took the whole drug spectrum. And it wasn't odd at all for the druggist to call me and say, Mrs. Mongris, there is a new prescription on the market, And I thought perhaps it might help you. And I'd say, well, Mr. Blank, you just send it out. Now, I never smoked pot, I never snorted cocaine, and I never used heroin for three reasons only. That's the medical profession, the pharmaceutical companies, and the liquor industry. With these three organizations going for me, I didn't need anything else to help get me through the day. But while this doctor was interviewing me, I told him, I said, now I drink nearly every day, and nearly every day I get drunk. I might even be an alcoholic. And he looked at me and smiled across that desk, and he said, oh, nonsense. A nice little woman like you couldn't be an alcoholic. I agreed with him 100%. But when my liver function test came back perfect, he showed it to me, and he said, now see, you couldn't be an alcoholic because all alcoholics have liver damage. So much for the doctor's misdiagnosis, by the way. But he was alarmed about my suicide attempts, which he attributed to depression. And I guarantee you that you are depressed when you wake up nearly every morning of your life with a hangover. And he put me on a weekly series of vitamin and hormone shots, and he put me on the amphetamine drug, which is the PEP pill. Now, this amphetamine is medication that is used for depression and is also used in weight control. Because what it does, it jazzes up your thyroid and gives you a lot of energy. And I destroyed my thyroid with these PEP pills. And it depresses the appetite centers in your brain, so you gin around a lot and you aren't hungry, ergo, you lose weight. But if you abuse these amphetamines the way I did, you will also lose some of your marbles. And I came home from this doctor's office with a clean bill of health, weighing 90 pounds, dripping wet, and a great big bottle of reducing medicine. But I still remember, 30 minutes after I took that first PEP pill, I thought I had been reborn. Oh, it was glory, glory, every step of the way. And I know I did 3 weeks' work in one afternoon, that one PEP pill. And when my husband came in from work that evening, my two sons met him at the back door and said, oh, Daddy, guess what? Mother feels good. And once again, I thought I had found the answer. But of course, this wonderful medication had a bad drawback to it. I was so exhilarated and happy I couldn't sleep. So I called the doctor to tell him about this, and bless his heart, he sure did want me to sleep. So he sent me my first prescription for the sleeping tablets. And I would get up in the morning and take a PEP pill, and I'd take a sleeping tablet at night. And the icebox is still full of beer, and I'm still alcoholic, and I reach in there and I start drinking again, and I start losing control, and I call the doctor about this, and he's of the opinion that the speed run of the amphetamine needed to be slowed down. And there was a brand new drug on the market called a tranquilizer. And he sent me a bottle, and it had the magic words on the thing, says, take as needed. So I was going every week and getting my vitamin and hormone shots. I was taking the PEP pill in the morning, the tranquilizer through the day, the sleeping tablet at night. And, of course, I was doubling and tripping up on these things. I was abusing drugs long before somebody ever coined that phrase. I'm still alcoholic. My icebox is still full of beer. And as an alcoholic, it is as normal for me to drink as it is for me to breathe. And I reached in that icebox and I started drinking again. Now my pattern was I'd start on beer and then I'd go to the liquor store. And when I started drinking mixing this alcohol with all this medication, it was taking a dreadful toll of me. Oh. My naturally curly hair became limp and stringy. I've always been just a little bit cross-eyed, and back in those days, I had to go around with one eye closed most of the time. I had a green cast to my complexion with undertones of yellow. I had lost 5 pounds on my reducing medicine. Now, if this isn't bad enough, skinny, cross-eyed, and green. I was growing a beard on each side of my face. and a very prominent mustache across my upper lip. Now, I don't know how long I had looked like this, but if I had been growing horns and a tail, my family would not have said a word to me, because they wouldn't want to do anything to upset Mother. And one afternoon, I had to go someplace and I had to fix my face. I had to powder my face. And this is when I made an amazing discovery. If you have a beard, you can't powder your face. It was going all over that room. And I looked through that haze of powder at myself and I nearly fainted. I thought, my God, surely I'm not supposed to be growing a mustache. And a beard. And I don't know where I was going that afternoon, but I hurried off to the doctor's office to show him this apparition that I was. And while I was waiting for him to come in to see me, I was just sick at heart. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I was kind of philosophical about it. I thought, well, if I have to start shaving every day, I guess I'll do it. And he came in and turned my face from side to side, and he said, honey, I'm not worried about that on your face. It's caused from the hormone shots. He said, I want to know if you're growing any hair on your chest. Well, this is the most insulting thing anybody ever asked me in my whole life. I started unbuttoning my blouse, and when I got to this button, it hit me what he had asked me, and I was raging mad. And I looked up at him and I said, I don't know, you son of a bitch. But I better not be. Yeah, I had trusted him and look what he had done to me. And I will say this, that I was spared the indignity of having any hair on my chest, growing on my chest. But if I'd have kept up with him, I don't know what would have happened to me. But anyway, you can bet all your blue chip stocks and your gold edge bonds I quit taking those hormone shots right then. And on the way home from the doctor's office, I swore up and down 1,000 different ways that I was never going to take another drink. I was going to get my life straightened out and everything was going to be all right. And I hadn't been home 30 minutes till I was drinking again and I didn't know what I was going to do. And it was along about this time that they were writing a lot of articles in the magazines and the newspapers about alcoholism and about the disease of alcoholism. And I'd read all these things avidly. And I made a decision that I'd go to the library and research alcoholism. In case I ever got it, I would know what it was. And in the library, there were two books on alcoholism. One of them was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the other was a book entitled Drinking Is Not the Problem. Well, you know which book I read first. And this man had lived with this woman for a number of years and gotten drunk every day. And just as soon as he quit her, he hadn't had a drink in over 2 years. And I read that and I thought, well, of course. It is all my husband's fault. I was grasping at straws. I've just quit my husband and I'll be all right. But right along behind that came another thought. Lord, if I quit Lenore, I'll have to go to work. And I had never worked a day in my life. And I was totally unemployable. And, but in reading the big book, they told me that alcoholism was a three-way disease. It was mental, and it was physical, and it was spiritual. And I thought, well, that's what's the matter with me. I'll go back to the church. I was raised in the church, and I'll go back to the church, and I'll get all right. And I went back to the Baptist church, and I didn't get all right. I went to the Methodist church, and I kept drinking. I went to the Catholic church. I tried all the denominations, and I kept drinking. I got special counseling downtown from the ministers at the big churches. And I'd leave there after they'd pray over me and talk to me. I'd leave there and just feel so good. And just as quick as I passed the liquor store, I'd turn right in there, and I was off and running again. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And the only weekend in all of our drinking that my husband was out of town, it was a cold February, and I was in the back of the house drinking and getting drunk, sobering up, and the boys were in the front entertaining themselves, and we had an agreement they would leave me alone if I would leave them alone. But I came to about 6 o'clock, and my conscience was just killing me. I was just eaten up with remorse. And I thought, I'll cook these boys something good to eat. And I went in the kitchen and I took an egg out of the icebox and I dropped it on the floor. And I reached in there and got another egg and I dropped it on the floor. And I looked down at those two eggs splattered between my feet. And I said, Lord, I am too drunk to cook. I take the boys to the drive-in. I wasn't too drunk to drive. And coming back from the drive-in, I missed my driveway and got stuck in the ditch in front of my house. And I couldn't get out. It'd been raining this about all day, and the more I tried to get out, the deeper in I'd get. Well, the boys ran next door to one of the neighbors. And I lived on a dead-end street, and there were four other families on this street. And none of these women could drive. The bus service didn't come down our cul-de-sac. I took all the kids to school and picked them up every day, drunk or sober. And I liked these women pretty good when I was sober, but when I was drunk, I just couldn't stand them. And you know whose fault it was that my car was stuck out there in my ditch. It was all their fault. And I got out of my car in a loud screaming voice, and I cursed these women. I called them everything in the book that I could think to call somebody. And when I was drunk and in a rage, I had the vocabulary of a mule skinner. And then came the dawn. Oh, Lord. The door, I woke up and I was freezing to death. The front door was open. The back door was open. It had rained in. And I walked to close the back door and I saw the two eggs. And I remembered vaguely about the two eggs. When I went to the front door to close it, I saw my car in the ditch, and I said, oh, my God, I knew what I had done the night before. And the next morning, I went around, and a miracle happened overnight. They became ladies overnight. And I went around and apologized to each one of them. I told them that I had been drunk the night before. I was ashamed of myself, and I asked them to forgive me. Now, several of the doctors... Now, this was the first time that my drinking had gone outside the confines of my home for a number of years, because 3 or 4 years previously, my husband had refused. He wouldn't take me out in public because we had to go out socially lots of times. In his line of work, we had to go socially. Of course, they always had cocktails. And I invariably, not every time, but nearly every time, I would start some kind of a scene with the biggest man in the room. He always 6'5" or 6' something like that. My husband is 5'8", and he'd have to come and rescue me, you know, to get me out of there, kicking and screaming sometimes. He brought me home one night, he set me on the bed, and he pointed his finger at me, and he said, Mary, I will never take you out in public again, because you are going to get me killed. And I was sober 2 or 3 years before he trusted me enough to take me out in public. So this was the first time it had gone outside my yard or my home. And several of the doctors had suggested that perhaps a psychiatrist might help me. And I wasn't willing to go to a psychiatrist till this happened. And I know I called him on Monday morning, and I was in his office bright and early Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock. And I thought about lying when I went to this psychiatrist because I wanted help so bad. And I thought, no, I better be honest with him. And I was. I leveled with him. I told him everything about me that I could think to tell. I told him about my erotic dreams. I told him about my sexual fantasies. I did not leave a stone unturned. And he made a decision to put me in Herman Hospital in February of 1949. That's before half of you in this room were born, to begin a series of insulin shock treatments. He wanted me to take 60, but we couldn't afford but 30. But I was grasping at straws. And all these shock treatments are brutal. I hated them. But if this was the price I had to pay to get well, I was willing to pay any price. And the psychiatrist came in every morning and every evening and talked to me, and we just got to be real good buddies. And I'd been in the hospital about 3 weeks, and he came in and said, Mary, I have some real good news for you. He said, you don't have anything to worry about because you are not an alcoholic. That's another misdiagnosis of me. I know I gained 20 pounds in the hospital. I had to borrow clothes to get home on. And I was unhappy with this diagnosis, but I couldn't do anything about it. And when I got home within 6 weeks, I was back again. So you know, drinking same old 6 and 7, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And it was after this that I tried other psychiatrists, I tried chiropractors, I tried psychologists, psychiatrists, faith healers, I was hypnotized. I would have embraced any cult or any creed to have found out what was the matter with me and to have gotten well. And I just get getting sicker all the time. But one of the psychologists working with my medical doctor put me on the drug antabuse. And this is medication. If it's in your bloodstream and you drink alcohol, it will make you violently ill and it could cause your death. But it didn't take this alcoholic long to know. And incidentally, I stayed sober 2 days to 6 weeks on antabuse. I'd go back to drinking and I'd drink 2 days to 6 weeks. It wasn't a very good way to live, I'll tell you this. But in 1962, I had to go to Wichita Falls to a wedding. And I filled myself full of antabuse so I wouldn't drink up there. And at the reception after the wedding, an aunt from another city, I was visiting with her, and I turned to walk away from Aunt Sydney, and she called out to me. She says, "Mary, by the way, said your cousin Gloria is moving to Houston. Said she is in AA now, and she's just doing beautifully." Sydney called these words out to me. A hush fell over that room. Everything got so still and so quiet you could have heard a pin drop. And in that moment of hush, I was given the knowledge that somehow, between Gloria and AA, I was going to be made whole again. Now, Gloria was a complete stranger to me. I'd never laid eyes on her in my life. And you would think I'd been trying 15 years to find some kind of help, but I'd come to Houston, locate Gloria, get in AA, and just my life would just be wonderful. And it didn't work out that way. I had a lot more drinking to do. But I did finally get in touch with Gloria. And she hadn't talked to me over 2 minutes till she said, "Why, Mary, you are an alcoholic." Now, this was the first diagnosis that was correct in all these years I had been trying to find some kind of help. And I remember how relieved I was to know what was the matter with me, but I still wasn't willing. I still couldn't stop drinking at that time. And she tells, she's passed away since then, but she said if I hadn't been alcoholic, she never would have had anything to do with me because she didn't like kin folks. So then her cousin didn't count anything. It had to be the alcoholic. But she talked to me for 13 months before I would go to my first AA meeting. And she would tell me I had a disease. It was progressive. It was incurable. And it terminates fatally. She'd scare me to death. She'd say an alcoholic has 3 choices. He can get locked up, covered up, or sobered up. And this would scare me to death. And I'd say, "Well, Gloria, I've never been in jail. I've never been involved in an automobile wreck. I've never been in a mental institution." Incidentally, I had over 100 shock treatments before I got to this program. And she said, "Well, honey, you just keep drinking and these things will happen to you." And I knew she was right. But in 1963, our youngest son went away to school. And this was the first time in all my years of drinking that I didn't have somebody coming home in the afternoon to monitor me to see if I was drunk or sober. They had to do it before they could ask their little friends over, of course. And this is when I nearly drank myself to death. I drank solid for 3 weeks. And it was during this time that I tried to commit suicide in a blackout. Now, this scared me to death. I took the attitude if I was going to commit suicide, I wanted to know about it. I didn't want to just wake up the next morning someplace dead. And this is when I got on the telephone and I called Gloria and I said, "Gloria, I need help." And she said, "Yes, honey, I know you do. We have been fooling around about this long enough." And that was the night that Gloria and Lee came out and made a 12-step call on me and my husband. And while I was waiting for Gloria and Lee to come out there, it was going to be a little bit late, I had on the same pajamas and housecoat that I'd had on for 4 or 5 days, maybe even a week, because I had a bad habit when I was on some of my drunks that I wouldn't take a bath, I wouldn't comb my hair, I wouldn't brush my teeth, I wouldn't do anything except drink. And that's the reason I just love to foo-foo up when I come to AA. I just foo-foo up all the time now. And I was remembering the time that my husband is such a fastidious alcoholic. He even takes showers during blackouts. he was revolting to me. And it just bothered him no end that I didn't clean up that fast for him. He just couldn't understand it. One afternoon, we were both about half drunk, and he made a terrible mistake. He decided he was going to give me a shower. It was a bad mistake. And when he took me in the bathroom and locked the door, I didn't know he was going to give me a shower. And when he started undressing me, I sure didn't know he was going to give me a shower. And when he got me completely undressed, he turned on the shower. While he kissed me with one hand, he turned on the shower, and then he shoved me in that shower stall. Oh, you talk about a letdown. Oh, I tell you, I'd come out and he'd push me back in. And finally he got in the shower with me, clothes and all, and got up behind me, swore up and down he was going to give me a bath, and I swore up and down he wasn't. And I started kicking, and I completely demolished all three sides of that shower. And the next day when he was trying to rebuild it, I kind of felt sorry for him. He looked up at me so pitiful, and he said, "I'll never try to give you another bath." I said, "That's a good idea, boy." Anyway, 3 or 4 weeks later, our sons were out on the back porch, and they were bored. All the kids in the neighborhood had something to do but them. And one of them said, "I wish something interesting would happen around here." The other one brightened up and said, "Say, maybe Daddy will try to give Mother another bath." But when I opened the door that night to Gloria and Lee, they were the most beautiful sight I have ever seen in my life. They were clean, they were sober, they were smiling, they were healthy, and they were well-groomed, and whatever they had, I wanted. And they came in, and we were visiting, and Lee caught my attention, and he asked me, he said, "Mary, if you could be granted one wish tonight above all others in the whole world, what would you ask for?" And without a moment's hesitation, I said, "I want peace of mind." To me, this was the treasure of all treasures. He said, "You want serenity?" And I said, "Yes." And in the promises, it tells us we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. And I start in AA, and I stay sober 90 days, and I get drunk. My husband came in AA for 90 days with me. He was going to get me sober so he could go on about his drinking, and he wouldn't have those doctor bills and drug bills and liquor bills to pay. And so he went to a Christmas party, and he came back that evening with a fifth of whiskey under each arm, just as drunk as Cooter Brown. Now, I'd been sober 90 days, but when I saw those two fifths of whiskey, one under each arm, I went into a blackout before I even took that first drink. And I woke up Christmas Eve morning, drunk, whiskey all over the room, hungover, and it was the first Christmas our little grandson was coming to spend Christmas with grandmother, and grandmother got drunk. But I did get through Christmas Day by the grace of God. I think I sipped on 2 beers. And the day after Christmas, my company left, and I was really fixing to tear on a tooth, get on a good one. And because AA didn't work, you know. So the telephone rang, and it was Lee, and he didn't ask me if I had a good Christmas, if I was drinking. All he said was, "I will be out tonight." And I remember thinking, now, if that busy man is going to come all the way out to my house to help me stay sober, I'm going to do my part. And I woke my son up, because he's home from school, and I told him, I said, "Now take my car keys, and don't let me have them, and do something with that beer in the icebox." And he did. And Lee came out that night, and I started back in AA. And several weeks later, I was out in the backyard, and I looked up. We have some 80 trees in our backyard, 80 feet tall. And I looked out there, and there was a brown paper sack way up in the tip top of that tree. And I was so puzzled, I thought a little squirrel couldn't carry that paper sack way up there. And then it dawned on me that that little old freshman had shinned up that tree because he didn't want his mother drinking anymore. So I came back in AA, and this time I stayed sober 108 days. And my husband wouldn't do to suit me. My son wouldn't do to suit me. Nobody would do to suit me. So I just got drunk. But I also wasn't following directions. I was doing it my way. But when I came off this last drunk, I don't ever want to forget that most horrible day of my life. My husband had to work that day, and he had to teach me all I have to do is drink two beers, and this nightmare will go away. But I also knew that day, if I drank, I would never sober up again the longest day I lived. And it was strictly by the grace of God that I hung on that day. And Glory came in that evening, and the first thing she said was, I had to get to an AA meeting. Well, my AA meeting was 20 miles across town. And I told her I wasn't able to drive, and I wasn't. I was in terrible shape. I just drank 2 days, but I was in terrible shape. She couldn't find anybody to come get me, and finally she got on the line, and she telephoned. She said, now, Mary, I'm going to tell you what you're going to do. You are going in your bedroom, and you're going to get down on your knees, and you're going to ask God to give you the strength to get to an AA meeting tonight. And she added one very important sentence, and she said, and he will give you the strength. And I did not have any place to turn. My back was to the wall, and this was the time I borrowed Gloria's faith when I went in my bedroom, and I got down on my knees, and all I said was, dear God, give me the strength to get to an AA meeting tonight. Now, and he answered my prayer. And I didn't know it at the time that I knelt in the first sincere heart prayer of my entire life, that was the moment that God started healing this shattered woman. Because from the moment I rose from my knees, I have never had a compulsion to drink. It was taken away from me at that moment. And I started back in AA, and this time, believe me, I am ready to obey. Whatever they told me to do, I would do, because I didn't want any more of this drinking. And incidentally, when I came in AA 26 and a half years ago, I weighed 75 pounds. I was just skin and bone, because alcohol made me skinny, and I wouldn't eat either. And as I got sobered up, I realized the glaring defect I had that was just bothering me no end. I was so sick inside, I could not give love to you. I didn't love anybody. I was too dead. And this bothered me. Everybody was so solicitous of me and loved me and calling me and everything. And there were times that I didn't even like you people in AA during this period. And Gloria and Lee told me to read the big book, read the 12 and 12, pray on your knees, and go to meetings. Those were the four requisites that I had to have. And in some of my readings, I came across a man in AA, I think he lived out in California, that felt just like I did. He was so dead inside that he couldn't love anybody. And he borrowed a prayer from someone in AA, and I borrowed it from him. And every night when I would go to bed, I would say, dear God, give me a small love to give, a small understanding, and a small love of which I might be worthy. And I don't have to tell you that this prayer has been answered 1,000 times over. And I didn't know who this guy was that was keeping me sober 24 hours at a time. The God of my childhood, the God of the Bible, was not the one I wanted in AA. And I was also having a hard time believing that I was created from some man's cotton-picking rib, too. So once again, they said, read the spiritual books, read the big book, read the 12 and 12, pray on your knees, go to meetings. And I came across something by an old-time philosopher named Pascal, P-A-S-C-A-L, and it was at the bottom of the page, limned in black, and it just jumped up. When I turned the page, it just jumped up at me. And all it said was, fret not thyself. If you had not found me, you would not seek me. Now, something happened to me when I read that little sentence. Something clicked very deep inside of me. Fret not thyself. If you had not found me, you would not seek me. And I knew at that moment that I had found God or God had found me. It doesn't matter which. And this was the beginning of a very slow spiritual growth in this sick woman. And it's still growing. And I'm grateful for it. It's not as big as I'd like for it to be, but it's big enough to keep me sober and happy and healthy and here with you tonight, so that's good enough. And I didn't know how to live one day at a time. This concept was so I was going to be happy when school started. I was going to be happy when the car was paid for. I was going to be happy at some future date. I did not know how to live today. And this, I came across something in some of my readings by Carl Sandburg. And he had written, and it, I know you've heard it, that life is like an onion. You peel it back one layer at a time, and sometimes you weep. And somehow or another, I could figure out my today by peeling back that onion layer one layer at a time. And that is how I learned to live, one day at a time. And I seldom ever weep. Seldom ever weep. And years, 100 years before coming into AA, I had made the mistake of my whole life. I had married a mother's only son. Don't y'all do that. You young gals, don't do it. Look at his mother first. And she was sick, neurotic, and possessive, and she hated me with a passion. I could do nothing right. It didn't make any difference what I did. I just couldn't hit the mark to save my life. And I hated her, and she hated me. And I want you, if y'all ever seen a barracuda, well, that's what she was. She was a barracuda. And you know, I was sober, and I was feeling good, and slowly getting a little bit rounded out. And I think of something she had said to me 10 years previously. Just blow my whole day. And this was going on more often than I like to think about. And finally, Gloria had had enough of this. And she says, Mary, if you don't quit hating this old woman, you are going to get drunk. And now this scared the liver out of me. And I said, now just how am I going to do that? She said, well, I'm going to tell you, but you ain't going to like it. Hand me my water, please. Thank you. And I said, now, just lay it on me. Tell me what I'm supposed to do. And she said, well, you're going to pray for this old woman. And I immediately said, the hell I will. And she had another important sentence. She said, you're not going to pray for this old woman for her sake. You're going to pray for this old woman for your sake. And when she put it to me like that, and I didn't want to get drunk, and I was obeying, and I went in my bedroom, and I stood in the doorway for a while. This is one of the hardest things I have ever had to do in my whole life, in my AA life. And I have a special place by my bed where I say my prayers. And when I got ready to pray for this old woman, I got clear around the corner of the bed, around the foot, around the other corner, way up in the back corner, just as far as I could get, because I didn't want to contaminate my good praying place. And I got down on my knees reluctantly, and I said, now, dear God, you know I don't mean a word I say. But you bless Ethel. And I got to where at the end of my prayers every night, I'd say, bless Ethel. Bless Ethel. You know? And one morning I woke up and something was different. It took me a little while to figure it out. But that was the moment that God had removed this hatred and anger that I had for this old woman. He had taken it away from me, and I no longer hated her. But she didn't change one damn bit. But you know, she didn't have to change. I am the one that had to change. And 28 days after I took my last drink, my husband came into AA for his sake. And he has been sober 26 years last May. And people used to come up to me and tell me that every once in a while they do it now. And they say, Mary, it must just be wonderful. You and Lenar are both in AA, and you can just have your own AA meeting. I want to punch them out. We can't even agree on the preamble. But he does it his way, and I do it mine, so that is working out all right. But I know tonight that my sobriety is by the grace of God, but the quality of my sobriety is up to me. And they taught me if I didn't give away my sobriety, I might not keep it. So I started getting active in AA, and I started sponsoring women and chairing meetings and being secretary and the board of trustees. I have done everything in AA that I could do because I wanted my sobriety to be worthwhile and to be a good sobriety. But my greatest treasure is sponsoring these young women in AA. And when a woman comes up and asks me to be her sponsor, I feel like it's a gift from God. But sometimes it backfires on me. But I just have to realize I don't get anybody sober and I don't get anybody drunk. And I have such a good time sponsoring these women in my life. And my husband is, he's an unadulterated, thoroughbred fishing addict. I can't stress that enough. That's all he ever wanted to do in his life is go fishing. And I never got to see the hills of Rome or, Eiffel Tower or the streets of London. When he had any vacation time coming, we went fishing. We went crappie fishing, freshwater fishing. And he was on vacation, and we'd been fishing 3 days, and he had just beat the socks off of me. And he asked me that night if I was going fishing with him the next day, and I said, heck no, boy. I can find something better to do with my time than to go out there and get humiliated by you. And I opened the gate for him to pull the boat out the next morning. And he said, you sure you don't want to go fishing with me? And I said, yeah, let me get my fishing hat. I ran in and got my little old disreputable fishing hat and knelt down by the side of the bed real fast. And I said, now, dear God, protect my home from tigers and let me beat Lamar catching fish. We were out there fishing, and I had him beat. We fished about 2 hours, and I said, let's go, Lenore. He said, nope. So we fished a little bit longer, and he was about to catch up with me. And I said, Lenore, let's go. I was just getting really impatient. And he said, no, I've at least got to get even with you. I might even beat you. And I said, you just forget about that. He looked at me. That got his attention. He looked at me, and he said, what do you mean? I said, well, when I said my prayers this morning, I asked God to let me beat you catching fish. Oh, he gave me the meanest look. He took his hat off and threw it in the boat, and he said, now, Mary, by God, that is dirty poo. Oh, I tell you, I am so grateful for my life in AA. And when I was drinking, and even now, I don't like to shop. My husband doesn't know what a little jewel he has in me, does he? And I had a friend call from Wichita Falls, and she wanted to come to Houston and pick out some crystal and china. And I said, yeah, come on. I said, I've been real sick, but we can do that. It took me over 2 years to recuperate even a little bit from the damage I had done to my body and mind and soul and psyche and everything. So I know I went in and told my husband, I said, Virginia's going to drive 500 miles to buy crystal in China. To me, that was the silliest thing I had heard of in my life. I didn't care about things like that. But when she came down, I took her in the crystal in China department of a brand new exclusive department store there, and I said, now you just sit, look to your heart's content, and I'm going in the furniture department, and I'm going to sit in one of those chairs and watch people. I wasn't able to stand up and shop with her at that time. I didn't want to give her any advice anyway because she didn't like it. She'd blame it on me. So as I turned to walk to the furniture department, I saw a picture at the back of the room. It was about as far as here to the back of that room, and it caught my eye. It was the prettiest picture I've ever seen, and the closer I got, the more beautiful it became. And when I got right up to it, I thought, that's the most beautiful picture I have ever seen in my life. It was a picture of roses. And I looked at the price tag, and it was $139. And Lord, we were so broke from all of our drinking. I couldn't afford $139. But the more I looked at that picture, that's when my heart started smiling. Because it wasn't important that I couldn't afford to buy this picture. The important thing was I could walk something again. I tell you, it was a beautiful thing. And 2 or 3 weeks later, I had to go in a department store to get something, and there was a mannequin there that had a black and white Chuck Taster raincoat on it. And this was the second thing I had seen since I'd been sober that I wanted. And it was just $10.95 or $9.95, I don't remember. Now, I could afford that. And this is just wonderful. I had found something I could afford to buy, and boy, I bought it. Now, it was way too big for me. It was size 8, and I think I wore about a 4, and they didn't make it that far about. Anyway, it had a tassel lining in it, and just as quick as I got home with my new raincoat, and I started hemming it up on the sleeves and under the bottom, and, oh, I looked outside, I wanted to start raining right then. You know, I didn't think it was ever going to rain in rainy Houston. It was 3 weeks before I even heard the pitter-patter of rain. You never saw an old drought farmer scat in the skies for rain the way I was looking, trying to find a little rain so I could wear my new... And the sun shined all the time for 3 weeks. That doesn't happen in Houston. But one afternoon, I heard the pitter-patter of rain on the roof, and I thought, oh, boy, I'm going to wear my new raincoat, and I'm going to Travis tonight. So I got in my car. My garage is attached to my house, and I got in my car and with my new raincoat, and I sung every step of the way to Travis Club. I was the happiest thing. This time I wanted to go to AA. Heretofore, I had been going to therapy. And when I got down to the Travis Club, I opened the door and saw how hard it was raining, and I got back in and closed the door, and I started dying. I started laughing to myself. I had been waiting 3 weeks to wear my new raincoat, and I didn't want to get it wet. I tell you, I have been given such a wonderful life in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's beyond my wildest expectations. And I love to be here with you tonight. I just feel like coming up here that I was going to collect a whole new family, because to me, you are my family. And I have loved being here. You've just been a wonderful audience. And I was going to tell you that I do have a lot of nicknames here in AA. I'm called Fast Draw. I'm called Hip Shot. I'm called Pistol Pete. I'm called Shotgun Mary. But I'm going to close tonight by telling you that because of the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, this pistol-packing mama has laid her pistols down. I thank you.